I'd like you to meet this true gentleman who shared his love of Scotland with so many travelers. A special tribute on Travel with Rick Steves. I'm Rick Steves, and this is Travel with Rick Steves. We're traveling now to Scotland, and I've got with me a friend who runs a bed and breakfast in the Highlands of Scotland in a little town called Glencoe, and he's graciously welcomed me and my travelers and our groups into his living room and shared the wonders of his corner of the British Isles. And today he's in our studio, and we're going to take you to Scotland with the help of Arthur Smith. Arthur, thanks for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Rick. It's delightful to see you again.
Thanks, Arthur. Now, you live in a little town called Glencoe. Is that technically in the Highlands of Scotland?
Very much. It's right in the heart of the Highlands.
Now, what does the Highlands mean exactly?
It literally means the Highlands, the mountains, which run in a circle from Perth and Dundee round to the north of Scotland.
So basically, if you're driving north from Glasgow, when do you hit the Highlands?
At Loch Lomond. About half an hour, 20 minutes from Glasgow Airport, you're driving up Loch Lomond.
Okay.
It's a very small country.
So you want to go to the Highlands. Everybody in Scotland goes to Edinburgh,
yes,
of course.
Yes, of course.
But you drive north half an hour, and you're in the Highlands.
Very much.
Now, I think you probably find classic Scotland more likely in the Highlands than
anywhere else.
Is that true?
It is. It's divided into the lowlands, the southern uplands, the central belt, which is heavily industrialised, and then the Highlands, which is one-third of the country with 3% of the population.
Is that right?
Yes.
One-third of the country of Scotland?
With 3% of the population.
My goodness.
So you've got the last wilderness in Europe.
Probably most of the sheep in Scotland.
Probably more sheep than people. Yes.
More sheep than people. Okay, now when we think of traveling in Britain, we've got Angles and Saxons. They came over ages ago. People from Europe invaded Britain. And these were Angles and Saxons. And my understanding, Arthur, is they took the best land and they established their communities there, and they pushed the people who were there earlier, the Celtic people, to the less desirable, more rocky fringes of the British Isles. And the Angles established what became Angleland.
Yes.
And then the Scots, Irish, and Welsh took what was left over.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, that's actually what happened. As you know, the Romans invaded us, didn't quite make it very far into Scotland, got defeated, went back and built a wall. And we, like Wales, Ireland and Scotland, but particularly Scotland, were left with what they thought was the poor ground.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it wasn't. We had gold, we had silver, we had pearls in the river, we had excellent water for making whiskey, we've now got hydroelectric, forestry, we've got the rich stuff.
And you got oil, don't you?
We've got oil, yes,
in Scotland.
In the North Sea, yes.
Does England take a little bit better care of Scotland because of the oil?
Well, yes, we take quite good care of England.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that you introduced the Romans to this story.
Yes.
When we think of Angles and Saxons who came over from, like, Germany.
Yes, Jutland.
What century would that have been, roughly?
What, the Angles and Saxons?
Yeah.
From the 6th to the 10th.
Okay, early Dark Ages.
Early Dark Ages.
After the fall of Rome. But the Romans were there before that, and they added to the mix.
They came 55 BC.
Okay, now, when the Romans came, they pushed as far north. I always thought they pushed as far north as Hadrian's Wall, but they actually went further and tried to subdue the Picts?
There is a more northerly wall than Hadrian's Wall. It was the Antonine Wall.
Okay.
And they got right up almost as far as Aberdeen. In fact, the Grampian Mountains are named after Mons Grampius.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Now, why didn't they just stay up in Scotland then? They could have taken the whole island.
We trashed them.
You trashed them?
Yes.
The Scots trashed the Romans.
Well, you see, the Romans fought in heavy armour in long lines in the link over peat bogs and mountains. Didn't work.
So the Scots in there, when you think
of guerrilla warfare, yes.
Guerrilla warfare, that's
it. Hit and
it.
Run and go, and they just...
So the Romans, overwhelmed by the Scottish guerrillas, basically, they retreated, and then they sort of drew a line across Britain, and they built Hadrian's Wall.
Yes.
And that was... fortified every mile with a mile castle.
That's right.
Wide enough for chariots to race atop the wall to
That's
refortify
right.
places mm-hmm. that were under attack. And they pretty effectively sealed off the rest of the island from
yes,
those
from
the Scottish
north and
guys.
The south. Yes.
All
and
right.
that became a division basically between Scotland and England.
Okay, yeah. Now, when I go to up in the north, I came to your house once and you gave me a bunch of little coins, little Roman coins. It just astounded me that you could, I mean, they weren't even very valuable. You just find these coins in the dirt?
Well, yes, my grandson has a metal detector and we go out. The Romans had a belief if you find a Roman road and go where they cross a stream, when the Romans crossed over a stream, they threw in a coin to appease the river gods. Yeah. And they always being miserable threw the smallest coin. So we find old maps, go down to where there was a bridge, and pretty soon you're going bleep, 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 and you're digging up coins.
So you get a metal detector, you go to where the Romans would have forded a river.
Yes, or a bridge.
And then for superstitious reasons, they would have tossed coins into the river.
Yes.
And they were cheapskates, so they tossed the smallest coins. And these are called?
Mites, a Roman mite, the smallest Roman coin.
A little mite. They're half the size of an American penny.
Very small.
And that's the same mite when we think about in the Bible when they said
the widow's mite, yes.
The widow's mite.
When the widow gave all she had, which was a mite. And Jesus said it was the most precious gift.
Beautiful. Now, when I'm in Scotland or any of the Celtic countries, I'm sort of charmed by the Celtic spirit. And I remember I was in a pub in Scotland and a band was playing. It was called the North Sea Gas.
Oh, yes.
And I looked around and I just saw a pride and a glimmer in people's eyes. And there was a real spirit of Scotland there. Does this survive even into the 20th century?
Very much so. The great game is football, of course. And when Scotland's playing the World Cup, all the supporters go dressed in kilts. It's called the Tartan Army. And it's amazing. It's one group that go to a village to play a football match, and they lift the ban on alcohol. They allow them to drink because they have such a good time.
Oh, that's
and
great.
Don't get rowdy.
And they don't get rowdy.
No.
But they've got
just
their,
get drunk.
They're the Scottish Army there for the game. Hey, we've got some people on the line, Arthur.
And yes, certainly.
I'm talking with my friend Arthur Smith, who is from a little town in the Highlands called Glencoe, and he's visiting us today. And I've got Jamie on the line, and she's from Somerset in Pennsylvania.
Hi, Arthur.
Hi.
My husband and I are just madly in love with Scotland. We travel fairly extensively in Europe, thanks to Rick's guidebooks and DVDs and shows that we covet. And my brother is getting married in May, and I am giving him, for a wedding gift, a honeymoon trip.
How nice.
And I'm wanting to send him to Scotland.
Yes.
We've been there several times, but we never seem to get out of Edinburgh, which has been wonderful, but I know there has to be more that we're missing.
Well, there's a lot more, yes.
And I'm wondering what you would suggest for a young couple, first time out of the United States, on a honeymoon trip.
Will you be hiring a car?
I'm debating about that because of the driving on the left. I think he might be a little nervous.
That is not a problem.
You know, there's
honestly
no traffic up there, so you've got it easy.
The roads are empty. And I find when I go abroad and I drive on the other side of the road, 2 hours and it's no problem. You fall in.
Yeah, Jamie, I've been saying this for ages, sending a lot of people who are ambivalent or a little nervous about this. And just pick up the car in the countryside if you can, like at the airport perhaps, and then you'll learn out in the country roads.
Okay.
And if anybody's coming head on at you, just be in a humble frame of mind, you're probably on the wrong side of the road.
Actually, if you hire a car in Britain, you get the car with the steering wheel on the side appropriate. And that really keeps you in tune with where you should be.
So the point is here, Jamie, Arthur, I think, is recommending you get a car, you'll have more mobility, and you won't be limited by the public transportation schedules to get to the little obscure places. Arthur, where should she go with the car?
Does your brother play golf?
No, he doesn't.
Oh, what a pity. We're the home of golf. Right, I think a wee run up to Stirling, visit Stirling Castle. On up to Balquhidder, visit the grave of Rob Roy MacGregor.
What is the town there, Arthur?
Balquhidder.
Balquhidder, okay.
Yes, Rob Roy MacGregor and his family are all buried in a little graveyard. And then just drive, wander up through the Highlands. Take your time.
Talk about the Isle of Skye. I think that is a very romantic place.
Oh, it is. It's a beautiful spot. There's two ways you can go to the Isle of Skye. You can drive up the coast road, the road to the Isles, to Malaig, and get the ferry across to Armadale. Or you can drive right up through the Highlands, past Elendoran Castle, and take the bridge across to Kyrie.
You know, Jamie, for me, the west coast of Scotland is just so enchanting and seductive in its beauty. Arthur lives in a little town called Glencoe. It's sort of it's one of many charming little towns. You stay in a B&B, take hikes, get an ordnance survey map, a very good map that shows the trails, and do some hiking, take a ferry boat out to some of the outer islands if you have the time. And I would say when you're in Edinburgh, be sure to hire a local guide, a local walking guide. They just have wonderful guides. They're very inexpensive. You can take a public one or you can have a private one. And the B&Bs in Edinburgh are great for a big city. And, of course, the B&Bs in the countryside are going to enable you to sit around a campfire, a hearth in the home, in the living room, and talk with these people who, in a lot of senses, Arthur, you have the world coming into your living room.
I don't need to travel. They're there.
You did B&Bs for, you just retired this year, but how many years did you?
15 years.
15 years. You had people coming from all over the world into your home.
Yes.
What was that like?
absolutely wonderful. We had some great nights. Some nights we didn't get to bed till 2 in the morning sitting talking. Other nights, you know, it depended on the mood of the person. But always it was very, very enjoyable.
I think that's a key when you're in Ireland or Scotland or Wales is to take some time with your host in the B&B. And remember, they genuinely enjoy opening their house
up to
people from around the world. Of course, it supplements their domestic budget. But they love to sit around and have some tea and biscuits or a little whiskey and tell stories.
Wonderful.
Jamie, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Arthur, you were running your bed and breakfast for 15 years.
Yes.
Now, what would we expect to pay for a B&B now for per person?
Well, a bed and breakfast in Scotland, in law, you cannot take more than six people. It must be your own house, and people come in and they treat it in Scotland as friends staying with you and paying for it. So you're not covered by business tax or business rates. So I was charging £15 a night.
Until last year. Now, in your town this year, people who are running small B&Bs?
£15, £18.
Okay, so even at a generous, I figure £20 per person.
£20 is very generous.
With a big breakfast included.
Oh, huge.
Scottish breakfast. Tell me what a Scottish breakfast is.
Oh, usually porridge, which is oatmeal, of course, cereal, sausage, bacon, egg, tomato, toast, marmalade, all usually homemade bread, homemade marmalade, butter.
Coffee, juice,
tea.
All right.
Ample supplies.
Now, I think traditionally the Scottish breakfast got you through the day if you're out working in the fields.
Yes. So that's what it was for.
Scottish fry.
You were out, yes.
All right.
Although not many of us fry now.
No. In old days, it was a lot of people called it a heart attack on a plate or a plate of cardiac arrest or something like this. And now I think B&Bs have contests, actually, for healthy heart awards and this sort of thing. So, but just so you're planning on your budget, you know, the dollar's not very strong. And Britain is very expensive as far as Europe goes these days. But if you stay in a B&B, you got it right from Arthur here, a top-end B&B in the countryside of Scotland would be £20 per person.
Yes.
Basically double that for dollars, £40 per person, $80 for the double in a private home with probably $30 worth of breakfast there. That includes
and
the
supper,
breakfast.
Usually a cup of tea at night, shortbread, home baking.
Is that right?
Yeah.
All right. Now, when we're thinking of traveling in Scotland, we encounter a lot of Scottish clichés, and it's sort of on people's list. One of the things is haggis. Now, when I go to Scotland, a lot of times I ask for haggis and they say, we dropped that from our menu 20 years ago. Go to a tourist place and you'll find some haggis. Are there any Scottish people that still enjoy haggis?
Quite a few, actually.
Is that right?
There's some very good haggises going about, but it became such a joke you tended to back off from it a bit.
What is haggis? What's in it? That's
it's the naughty parts of a sheep.
The naughty parts of a sheep.
Yes. Minced up with oatmeal and spices and boiled up. It's actually quite delicious. Anybody who's come to my bed and breakfast and I've served it to, the plates were cleared.
I find it a little rich but very tasty.
It's tasty but rich.
You don't want to eat a lot of it.
No.
Just in a nutshell, Arthur, how do you make haggis or do people actually make it or do you buy it?
I buy it from the butcher.
And what is it in it again? It's the naughty parts of the
sheep, the heart, the lungs, the brains, right, the intestines, minced up with oatmeal and spices. Boiled inside the stomach.
Spices, so different regions would have different
spices,
magic little mix and so on. And it has a history.
Oh, yes. We were a poor country. We wasted nothing. We ate everything. And the parts were a wee bit unappetizing. We beefed up with spices.
You know, I find all over Europe they have what I think of as foods of sort of to remember the hardships of your ancestors.
Yes.
You know, in Norway they've got the lutefisk.
That's right.
And it was how the people ate a long time ago when they didn't have refrigerators. They had to basically soak their cod in lye or whatever. And in Scotland you will have the haggis, and it reminds the people of the struggles they had back in a simpler age, and it stays alive today. You got to try haggis at least once when you're in Scotland. Also, when people are in Scotland, you'll encounter people. Now, actually, everybody wants to see people with bagpipes and kilts. And when I drive around, I see bagpipers in their full regalia on the street corner playing the bagpipe for tips, for tourists, basically. But are bagpipes still an integral part of the cultural scene, would you say?
Well, it is, because Scotland was militarily a very, a very military country.
Mm-hmm.
After the clans were abolished, after Culloden, the military regiments took over the place of the clans. and the bagpipes played a big part.
Is that right? So the clans really were the social design, and then no more clans when the English came and subdued you.
After Culloden, when the clans were abolished, they formed the regiments. And, and the only way you could bear weapons or wear a kilt was to join the military. And the old regiments are really the old clans. My old regiment, the Argylls, were really the Argyll clans.
Now, you gave me a scarf that has your regiment's tartan
right.
on it.
The Argyll and Southern Highlanders.
This is a beautiful, beautiful scarf, and it has your tartan. Yes. And that would have been your
military
regiment tartan.
Yes.
So they knew where you were from.
Yes.
And that would actually indicate, previous to the Culloden, when the English beat the Scots and abolished the clans, this would have been your clans?
No.
Or somebody's clans tartan? Or how does that work?
That actually is a military tartan.
Okay.
But it's made darker because we didn't want it to be too obvious. It's camouflage.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, the English, we had the clan situation, and we've all heard of the massacres and so on. Give me a little, did this really happen? What was the most famous massacre?
Well, in our village, the massacre of Glencoe.
Right.
When King William's troops, when 128 troops were billeted in the Glen under a Major Duncanson, they stayed for 12 nights, which allowed another 600 redcoats to come up.
So hang on, when the English were there, you Scottish people had to house the troops in your homes.
You have to. Billeted. This is the laws of hospitality. This is where bed and breakfast came from. It's a rough country. It can be hard in the winter. If somebody comes to your door and asks for shelter, you have to give it to them. And once you've broken bread with them and eaten their salt, you're safe, no matter who they are. And this is why that redcoats had stayed for 12 nights and then started killing. It left such a bad impression. Murder under trust.
The murder under trust.
Yes.
You had welcomed them into your homes.
Stayed with them for 12 nights and then...
And this led to some...
Well, this was really the start of the Jacobite uprisings.
Okay.
When we tried to get the Stuart family back on the throne of Britain.
And that was powered by the fact that Scottish people tend to be more Catholic and English are more Protestant. Is that right?
Not really, no.
Wasn't a Catholic thing?
No.
Okay.
The Catholics came into Scotland more when the Irish potato famine came and they came across from Ireland to live in Scotland.
Okay.
But Scotland was Presbyterian, really.
Okay. Now, when the English came and wanted to assert themselves on Scotland, a lot of times you had to hide your weapons because they wouldn't allow you to have swords. Is that right?
That's right. Well, after Culloden, the weapons were banned and we had to hide them. And in our village, when we were stripped off the old thatch and we came home from the war, we found swords, we found muskets, pistols, targes, all hidden after Culloden in 1745.
In the thatched roofs of your village?
In the thatched roofs of the village.
From when?
From 1745.
So over 200 years later, they changed the thatch and they discovered these old Scottish weapons.
Yes.
My goodness. Where are they now?
In the museum.
So your little village has a museum.
Yes, we have.
All right. When the English came, no more kilts, no more bagpipes, no more Scottish language even?
Well, no, it remained. Although when I was growing up as a small boy in the 20s and 30s, we used to get our fingers strapped at school for speaking Gaelic in the playground. You had to speak English.
Is that right?
It died out, but it's made a comeback now.
People are actually speaking Scottish now.
The Gaelic has made quite a comeback, yes.
Huh, interesting. Because I know in Wales and Ireland, the Gaelic or the Celtic language is strong. Hey, Arthur, we've got somebody else on the line here.
Yes,
we've got
certainly.
Connie in Bethesda, Maryland. And Connie is interested in information, I believe, on the Hebrides. Connie, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thanks for your call. What's on your mind?
Yes, my husband and I are interested in going to the Hebrides. We've been talking about it for some time.
Yes.
We have teenage sons, and we'd like to make a family trip, and possibly the Orkneys or the Shetlands. I'm not sure how they compare with one another. I was wondering if you could give me some information for first-time visitors.
Yes. Now, do you want to go to the Hebrides, or do you want to go to Orkney and Shetland?
I've been reading more on the Hebrides.
Yes. Well, my favorite island is Harris and Lewis, the Long Island.
Okay.
And you get the ferry from Ullapool across. And what I love there is the beautiful sandy beaches, and because the Gulf Stream comes across from the Atlantic, we have Caribbean water and beautiful white sandy beaches.
Mm.
But in Lewis itself, there's the standing stones at Callanish. You know what standing stones are?
Like Stonehenge.
Yes,
yeah. Well, these have been there since before Moses led the children of Israel out of Egypt. Our standing stones at Callanish are older than the pyramids.
My goodness.
And it's wonderful just to walk among them and feel the history.
Connie, excuse me, just for our listeners, you got the lowlands where you've got Glasgow and Edinburgh, and then you go north, you get the highlands where you get more dramatic culture. And then off of the west coast of Scotland, we've got the Hebrides Islands, right?
Yes.
And then further away, like in the almost in the neighborhood of Iceland, we've got Shetland and Orkney Islands.
The Northern Isles, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Connie, any more thoughts on that?
Well, I was wondering, is it best to get a car and take the ferry
over? Oh, yes, yes. Oh, please. Take a car around the islands. What to do is CalMac, which is our big ferry company, you can get a Rover runabout ticket, which lets you roll on and off all as many islands as you like for one payment.
Mm-hmm.
And if your car's a kind of reasonable size, it's not too bad.
Right.
But check it on the internet.
Okay. And is it also best to go in the summertime or springtime okay?
May and June. Because we're so far north, I lived just somewhere north of Juneau in Alaska in latitude.
Mm-hmm.
In May and June, there's 18, 20 hours of daylight.
Hmm.
It gives you a very long day and some beautiful scenery.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, Connie, I would imagine if you're tooling along the island of Harris or Lewis or these other islands, the island of Mull or the island of Skye, you probably don't need reservations in B&Bs if you're exploring, or what would you say, Arthur?
Well, if you're in the shoulder months, if you're away from the school holidays, you're probably all right.
And the school holidays would be
July and August. Yes.
Okay, yeah. So July and August you'll have long days and better weather, but you'll have a lot more school crowds and local tourists,
yes.
I suppose.
You'll get better weather in May and June than you will in July and August, though. The weather's normally better then.
Does that help you out, Connie?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Good luck on your trip.
Oh, thank you.
Enjoy it, yes.
We also have Amanda on the phone in Seattle. And Amanda, you're thinking of day trips to distilleries from Edinburgh, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I went to Isla via Glasgow last time, and
yes.
So this time I'm heading to Edinburgh.
Yes.
And I was wondering if it was possible to take some day trips out of Edinburgh to distilleries or to explore out there, and if I needed a car for that.
You need a car. The distilleries are a wee bit out of Edinburgh.
Yeah, I know. They're
in the Highlands more, to get the traditional...
Before we go any, I want to talk more about that, but let's make it very clear to our listeners that whiskey is a big deal, and there's Irish whiskey and there's Scotch whiskey, right?
Yes, spelled differently.
I would like Arthur to explain the difference between Irish and Scotch. Is there a difference?
There's a difference in flavour, and it's a question of taste. But the Scottish whiskey generally is a worldwide leader.
It may be a worldwide leader. The Irish would say the Irish whiskey, I think, is triple distilled and the Scotch whiskey is double distilled. Is that a qualitative thing or a taste thing?
Well, it's a taste thing.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
And in Edinburgh, you have some very tacky whiskey tours. Lord,
there's
Disney
a whiskey
kinda.
Trail.
That's very, very goofy. Yeah. And I would be sure, Amanda, that you would – actually, there are some whiskey shops that are quite classy at the bottom of the Royal Mile in Edinburgh.
Yes.
But let's get back now to Arthur talking about leaving Edinburgh to get to the real distilleries.
Yes.
And do they welcome tourists?
Very much. Most of them have a guided tour that take you around, explain how it happens, and then you finish up with just a wee dram, So you go with a smile on your face. But there's whiskey distilleries all through the Highlands. The best part is down the Spey Valley. There's an actual whiskey trail. It'll give you a map. You can go into all the distilleries and taste the difference yourself. There's no point in me saying which is the best whiskey. The best whiskey is the one that you actually like.
Amanda, any other questions?
That's great. So if I wanted to base myself, say, in Speyside or something like that to visit a bunch of distilleries and kind of a day thing, if it's too far out from Edinburgh, is there a good town or any specific place that would be great to go stay in?
Well, Granton in Spey, down the Spey Valley, is probably the capital of the Spey Valley, Granton.
Mm-hmm.
And you could quite a few distilleries within easy reach of that.
And the tourist board, I'm sure, produces this whiskey trail
with all
the specifics.
Once you get there, go to a tourist information office and you'll get all the details there.
We've had some very good tours in different places around Scotland. And from my experience as a tour guide, it's always been time very well spent for our groups, Amanda.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Have fun on that trip.
I'm excited.
Okay.
Look forward to seeing you.
Somebody else emailed us, Arthur, and they said, so what's under the kilt?
Ah,
I got to say, Arthur's wearing his Scottish outfit right now, and we'll get to what's under the kilt later. But right now, Arthur, take me on just a little tour of your traditional Scottish garb here. You've got it's so beautiful.
Well, the kilt, of course, it was worn in the Highlands when we were herding the cattle. I've got 10 yards of cloth wrapped round about me, and my legs are bare, which meant I was nice and warm, but could out with the cattle. I could wade through rivers and lochs and not get my trousers wet.
Okay, so this was anticipating going through a wet brush and
yes,
so on. You got 10 yards of cloth wrapped around. Okay,
yes.
And what attaches it?
Oh, two buckles at either side. But basically, it's held in by a big heavy belt. And then because you don't have pockets, you wear a sporran, which is just a pouch that you hang around your waist. And inside there, you have the traditional credit cards, traditional car keys.
Your cell phone.
The traditional cell phone, yeah.
So you got a sporran that looks like Daniel Boone's hat, I think. Didn't he used to wear a raccoon?
That's an otter.
This is an otter. Your sporran
is an otter. Yes, or it was an otter.
It was an otter.
You see, it used to be...
It's the size of a woman's purse. It's a round otter purse.
The word sporran means purse in English.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's all it is.
And now, what would Rob Roy have in his sporran?
Probably food, oatmeal. It might have a little glass of whiskey.
A little flask of whiskey?
Yes.
Okay.
Probably oatmeal and... a handkerchief or something,
Okay, just the little camp out stuff.
Yeah,
and today Arthur Smith would have his car keys and his cell phone in it,
yes.
And he'd hop in his modern car with his sporran and his kilt.
Just the same as always.
Now, you flew to the United States, and
yes.
I know you've got a little knife in your stocking, don't you?
A ski-in-do, yes. It's traditional.
What is that called?
A ski-in-do. Literally, it's a black knife.
Okay.
And it's a very traditional thing, and all the Highlanders carry one.
And is it a functional thing today or a decorative thing?
It's functional.
For what? What do you need a knife for, huh?
Well, you never know.
You never know.
You never know. No, it's actually, it's been a tradition granted to us to carry weapons. Obviously, coming over by Continental, I put it in my luggage.
Right. Yeah. Now, what is exciting to me as Europe is uniting is that the regions of Europe are able to exercise their traditions and their independence a little more openly.
Yes.
And my take on this is as Europe unites, as Belgium becomes the center of Europe, national capitals like London are less threatened by regions like Scotland.
Yes.
Consequently, in the last couple of years, Scotland has been allowed to have its parliament meeting actually back in Scotland for the first time since, 1711?
1707.
Scotland's got a new parliament now.
It has.
How is it going?
Not very well, I'm afraid.
Tell me about that.
Well, it turned out to be not very popular.
The Parliament.
It turned out to be very, very costly.
Yeah, the building.
The building was supposed to cost 40 million. It's cost well over 400 million.
But what about the actual governing body? You actually have more sovereignty now?
We used to have 76 MPs sitting in the House of Commons. And they discussed Scottish business here and then come up and discussed it in Edinburgh. Now we've got an extra 129 MPs.
So it's a bigger bureaucracy.
It's a bigger bureaucracy.
In a very expensive building.
As my grandfather used to say, he had a soft spot for politicians. It's a peat bog just further down the road.
I think a lot of people can relate to that,
yeah.
Arthur. Well, so you've got a parliament. It's open to tourists. It's a remarkable building at the bottom of the Royal Mile in Edinburgh.
Yes.
And Scotland is able to wear your kilt, play your bagpipes, speak your language.
Right? Yes.
No problem at all.
Can I just explain, when you talk about the Royal Mile, that's a mile from the gates of the Castle of Edinburgh to the Palace of Holyrood House where the Queen stays. So the King and Queen stayed in Holyrood House and it was 1 mile to Edinburgh Castle and that's the Royal Mile.
And it's one of the most historic walks,
I think, in all of
Europe. You've got John Knox's house in the church where he preached the Reformation in Scotland. You've got the home of... Walter Scott and Robert Louis Stevenson and these guys.
Conan Doyle.
Wonderful, wonderful walk. And, of course, you can tour the castle, which is one of the great historic places in all of Europe.
Well, we have the oldest crown jewels in Europe in the castle, the Scottish crown jewels.
And when you enter the castle, you see a statue of William Wallace, I believe.
Yes.
And a lot of Americans know William Wallace from the movie Braveheart.
Oh, that was filmed just next Glen to me, yes.
Now, you've got a lot of Americans coming into your B&B.
Yes.
How is their – have they learned from the romantic movies, Rob Roy and Braveheart, or has that messed up their perspective?
No. Okay, they were movies. They did take a bit of liberty with them, but basically the things were right. And Robert the Bruce and William Wallace led to the independence of Scotland. And the 6th of April, 1320, was the signing of the Scottish Declaration of Independence. And we've been independent ever since. We have a union with England, but we're independent.
Explain that to me. You've got England, you've got Wales, you've got Scotland, North Ireland,
yes.
and the Republic of Ireland.
Yes.
Now, there's a difference between England and Scotland and England and Wales, right?
Yes.
How is the relation different?
Well, Wales is a Celtic enclave. But it's not a kingdom, it's a principality.
Okay.
So it didn't have the power. There was a wall around Offa's Dyke.
Right, Offa's Dyke. So, but Wales was never really as much of an established political entity.
No, as Scotland was.
Scotland was a kingdom.
A kingdom,
so
yes.
The United Kingdom
yes.
is putting England and Scotland together.
United as a kingdom. Yes.
Nothing to do with Wales or Ireland?
No, they joined later.
Ah, okay, I didn't know
so
that.
So the Union flag is the flag of Wales, the flag of Scotland, England, and Northern Ireland superimposed on each other.
Wonderful. Arthur, this is fascinating. I'd love to talk to you more, but right now I just feel like getting on an airplane and flying to Scotland.
We'd be delighted to see you.
Thanks so much for your interesting information on your beautiful country.
Thank you.
Each year, Rick Steves Tour Guides take thousands of free-spirited travellers on escorted tours through Britain, Ireland and beyond, one small group at a time. For example, just for Britain and Ireland, you can choose from four exciting itineraries. For a free tour catalogue and Rick Steves Tour Experience DVD, visit the tour section at ricksteves.com.